Tonight we'd like to move from the comparative safety of the church walls and the height of German pulpits to that kingdom of the left, that left hand of God and that secular world. But it's a little strange for us in Washington, D.C. There are no kings. We are at a place, however, where the church meets the government, with all of the risks and the murkiness of how the church carries out its ministry in God's created world. We stress tonight the importance and the goodness of politics in 1983. Justice linked with salvation, advocates of the church serving in a ministry, people of the church serving their vocations in government, and what we have often described in that kind of ministry here as the interaction in that zone of exchange between church and government. Tonight we have an opportunity of hearing a man of the church involved in that political service. Paul Simon was born November 29th, this very month, in the year of 1928 in Eugene, Oregon. Many of you are aware of the traditions of his family, his father having served as a missionary to China, as a pastor here in the United States, and moving to Illinois in later years. Paul attended the University of Oregon as well as Dana College. His brother Arthur is known to many of you as the active leader of Bread for the World. At the age of 19, Paul Simon owned a weekly newspaper. He became a regular crime fighter, and to some of us of graying and thinning locks, we remember the Senator Estes Kefauver Crime Commission hearings. Paul Simon was one of the star witnesses before that particular commission. His wife, the former Jean Hurley, and he were married in 1960. She also was a member of the state legislature at that time in the state of Illinois. Their children are Sheila and Martin. Paul has written at least 5 books. The latest reading I had of his resume, and one that is particularly meaningful to me in a similar ministry in New England, was a book about Roman Catholic Protestant marriages, which described his in all of its beauty and meaning and as a family. I have the privilege of introducing Paul Simon as a person not only of the church and family, but of government, as we've indicated. He served 4 terms in the House in the state of Illinois, 2 terms in the Senate, and was lieutenant governor. Paul knows that there are times when you lose an election, a very close one, by 2 percentage points for the governorship of that state. Every year that he served, he was elected as the best, or nominated to be the best legislator by those who conducted those polls. He moved into the United States level, the federal level of government, by being elected to the House of Representatives in 1974, again in 76, 78, 80, and 82. One of those elections was close, was in 1980, when some of those masquerading, especially as the religious voice, targeted him as one of those of zero moral rating. I don't think it was any lower than that, was it, Paul? I mention that not just for that kind of reaction, but to set the stage for saying that I often speak of Paul Simon as the kind of person, were we to ask the members of the House, 435 of them, to nominate the 5 most respected fellow servers in Congress, it is my guess that Paul Simon would appear on most of those lists. He is given disclosure of all of his expenditures and income since 1954. He has his staff do the same in these days. In notes and conversations, there's been an undergirding factor of the kind of person that serves in Congress with the name of Paul Simon, a friend of the church, participant in Lutheran World Federation gatherings, a supporter of the most important kind of legislation for the poor, for social justice, and deeply involved in the programs for public education. He's also known as the man with the bow tie. Paul serves on two important committees this year in the House, the Committee on Education and Labor, the Committee on Science and Technology. In the prior committee, he is also chairman of the subcommittee on post-secondary education. You may have seen some of the hearings have been held by that committee about the importance of that level of training and development. Paul Simon is a friend of the church's ministry in Washington, D.C. He is a voice of distinct clarity, a congressman of deep integrity, a Lutheran of sure conviction, a secular human of the highest order. It is my privilege to consider him a friend, and I am proud to introduce to you Paul Simon.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I thank you very, very much, Dr. Chuck Bergstrom and friends. It's a pleasure to be here. My apologies for being here late. We have been voting over on the floor in the House, and I'm pleased to say we're in the process of adjourning right now, and I'm not going to miss any more votes this evening. It's a pleasure to be introduced by Chuck Bergstrom, who does a very effective job, not only for the Lutheran Church, but for good causes generally. And I appreciate being introduced by him. I mention this particularly because I just met his mother-in-law, and I want you to know that he is a good man here. Hubert Humphrey used to say, behind every successful man stands a surprised mother-in-law. And it is great to see you. And as I look over the audience, I see all kinds of familiar faces, Ralph Mohring, Ed Mundinger, former ambassador. You and I got an honorary doctorate together way back when one time. And if I can make one other side note before getting into the substance of my remarks here, Chuck mentioned the Christian Voice rating based on certain things that the Moral Majority picked. And that first year they came out with a rating, I did get a 0%. My colleague Bob Drinan, who was a Jesuit priest by background, also got 0%. Bob Edgar, a Methodist minister by background, managed to get 8%. But one of our colleagues, whose picture you saw on television stuffing money into his pocket, managed to get 100% on the rating. One of the items they chose as a determinant of whether you were voting morally or voting immorally was if you voted to fund the Centers for Battered Spouses. This was listed as an anti-family vote, one of those kind of twists of logic I've never quite figured out. Those of you who know me know that I speak ordinarily from notes. I do not read anything. But about once every 3 years, I am invited on some occasion to say something in an area where my knowledge is limited, where I have to do some research, And if I have to go to the trouble to type something out myself, I hate to say it, I inflict on the audience what I have gone to the trouble to type. I note one other person I should acknowledge, and that is the chaplain of the house, who has a Lutheran heritage also. Jim Ford, it's good to have you here. Was Pavel... You have a relative over here, Jim. Was politics important in the life of Martin Luther? What has been Luther's impact on the political scene? What can we learn looking at the life of Luther? I make no pretensions of being a Luther scholar, but since receiving this fascinating invitation, I have delved more deeply into the turbulent times and the turbulent man. They both involve religion and politics. There never has been and never will be a wall of separation between church and state, to use a phrase taken out of context from a letter written by Thomas Jefferson. But there is a distance between church and state in most nations today that was unknown in Luther's time. The most dramatic exception to that distance, ironically, in some of the communist countries, where adherence to the religion of non-religion is promoted much more assiduously than is in religion in most nations in which there is, in theory, a close tie between church and state, such as Great Britain and Italy and the Scandinavian countries. In a few other countries, such as Iran and Saudi Arabia, the ties between religion and government are extremely close. But in the late 20th century, such nation states are the exception. In Luther's day, rulers of the state made religious decisions, and rulers of religion made political decisions. Voices were rare who questioned even the possibility of any other arrangement. Into that environment, Martin Luther was born. His father, known affectionately as Big Hans, was elected to serve on the town council of Mansfield when Martin was eight years old. Mansfield had a population of approximately 3,000. At age 13, Martin went to school at Eisenach, a town of 2,000 population. Martin stayed with relatives, one of whom, his mother's brother, was elected mayor of Eisenach the year young Martin arrived. Luther grew up in an atmosphere in which government service was expected, appreciated, and understood. A great variety of things shaped Luther's attitude toward government, including an incident that took place in Erfurt, population then about 20,000, where at the age of 27 he served as a young priest and teacher. Workers rebelled at their low wages, ultimately burning two university buildings and capturing the mayor who was carrying out the orders of his ruler. The mob beheaded the mayor. The grim incidents which took place found Luther and the other Augustinian friars trying to preserve some semblance of order. The general characteristic of those times is that violence and death and a fairly grim life were everywhere. Luther's father was the operator of a foundry and small mines. To this day, mining is one of the more dangerous occupations. And there is something about danger, whether in a coal mine or in the army, that brings out the best and the worst, a feeling of comradeship and working together, but also hard talking, sometimes hard drinking. Virtually everyone in Luther's day carried a weapon. How many of Luther's brothers and sisters died at infancy, neither he nor the family remembered. It was commonplace. Not that death then became easy to accept. We weep with Luther when he learns about his father's death. And we understand his anguish as his 13-year-old daughter dies in his arms. But the threat of death from violence or plague or the host of uncontrollable illnesses hung constantly over everyone. Few lived long. Life was not pleasant by our standards, and unorganized political unrest erupted regularly from people oppressed by their political and church leaders. Into this atmosphere came a bright young man, the future reformer. His crudeness, as well as his courage, emerged from this milieu. He was engaged in the strong mixture of politics and religion before he posted his 95 assertions in the door of the University Church at Wittenberg. The 33-year-old Augustinian faculty member who sought debate instead created a revolution and dramatically changed history. Protected by a Roman Catholic ruler, Frederick the Wise, Luther tried to change and later attacked the established church, and he found himself working with rulers as much as theologians. He admonished those who governed and was admonished by them. He sought their counsel almost as much as he provided it. And frequently the advice of officials tempered the actions and letters of the strong-willed reformer. At the age of 62, then an old age, Luther traveled in the cold winter to mediate a conflict between two counts. The trip was too much for an already unhealthy Martin Luther, but typical of the workaholic, he remained to the end. Despite being seriously ill, he settled the dispute, preached four sermons, founded a school, wrote letters, and ordained two pastors. But his work and his life came to an end on this trip on February 18, 1546. Those 62 years changed the life of government and the church. For the open questioning of authority of all forms remains part of our religious and political heritage. We cannot measure to what extent freedom as we know it is a product of Luther's deeds, but we do know that nothing has been the same since Luther. This is not to suggest that despotism in either religion or government is a relic of the past, but today there is no universal acceptance of the edicts of rulers, even in the states where open dissent is not tolerated. For even in those countries, the door of freedom has been opened slightly. Rulers fear the unleashing of information, as did the church in Luther's day. It is doubtful that Martin Luther would leave the Roman Catholic Church of today changed so markedly from his day. In Rome this year, the Pope will speak at services at a Lutheran church honoring Luther's birthday, and in Chicago, Cardinal Bernardine and Dr. Martin Marty will join in a service at Holy Name Cathedral, also honoring Luther. How the Roman Catholic Church has changed since Pope Paul IV wrote, and I quote, "Even if my own father were a heretic, I would gather wood to burn him," end of quote. At the Diet of Worms, Luther appeared before a 21-year-old emperor, Charles V, who was ill-equipped to handle a theological dispute handed to him by church and state. Pope Leo X, named a cardinal at the age of 13 before he became a priest, named Pope 4 days after becoming a priest, in his papal bull of excommunication, called Luther, I quote, "a wild boar," and with some accuracy. But a boar who today perhaps would be nothing more than a popular faculty member, prodigious author and composer in the much different church world of 1983. The heritage of Luther is cultural, religious, and political, and no one can completely divide the three. He unified Germany by providing a common language through his biblical translation. He wrote hymns and started congregational singing, earning at least a footnote in musical history for that. At the castle at Coburg, he translated Aesop's fables into German. He was a multidimensional person who grieved at the death of friends, but who could be amazingly insensitive at other times. There is a dimension to Luther, as with all of us who share the burden of sin, that is much less attractive. He advocated the burning of witches. His statements of attack against the Jews in his later years are both crude and cruel. He called Copernicus a fool for believing the earth goes around the sun. His language was often so coarse that no television station would dare use it today. nor would any Lutheran publication consider printing it. He circulated cartoons that even today's grocery store weeklies with their low standards would not use. He was a man who could be wrong on a grand scale as well as right. After Luther's death, there was a century of bloody religious war in Europe, bloodshed that Luther doubtless would have tried to stop. Today, religious bloodshed continues in Northern Ireland, in Iran, and elsewhere. It makes no more sense today than it did in the 16th century. Where we can, we must convey the message that violence is no way to spread belief. Luther was concerned with the arrival of, and I quote, the modern canon, end quote. He commented, and again I quote, I think these things were invented by Satan himself, end quote. How appalled he would be at today's modern weaponry. Building bridges of understanding to those within Christendom and beyond the confines of our faith would be an appropriate tribute to Luther. If all of us who are children of the Reformation, and that includes literally all of humanity, would attempt to understand the beliefs of others more, violence could be reduced. Protestants must understand Roman Catholics. Sunni Muslims must understand Shiite Muslims. And there must be thoughtful study across the larger barriers so that Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and others do not find faith a cause for bloodshed. We can learn from Luther's courage and faith and also from his mistakes. Crudeness in language was not uncommon in Luther's day, and as it is not in ours. Princes and other government leaders with whom Luther worked often were able to persuade Luther to soften the message. But part of the bitterness that constituted the heritage of the Reformation on both sides came because of the intemperate language used by Luther and his opponents. When Luther's followers were attacked by an intemperate treatise written by Duke Johann Friedrich, Luther wrote a pamphlet in response titled, and incidentally, Luther's pamphlets ordinarily had very brief titles, but this one is titled, True, Steadfast, Well-Rounded, Christian, and Sincere Reply to the Shameless, Calphurnic Book of Infamy and Lies by the Godless, Accursed, Execrable, Defamer, Evil-Working Barabbas, also horror-addicted Holofernes of Braunschweig, who calls himself Duke Heinrich the Younger. Some of the things Luther wrote in that polemic and in other documents are not recommended for public recitation. One of the lessons of a look at that period is that bitterness breeds bitterness, and gestures of kindness can also be reciprocated. One interesting example of the latter is that when Luther married at the age of 41, 8 years after posting his 95 Theses at Wittenberg, Cardinal Albrecht, Archbishop of Magdeburg and Mainz, and Roman Catholic prelate of Germany, sent Martin and Katie a substantial wedding gift. While the relationship between Luther and the cardinal later deteriorated, for years Luther refused to attack the cardinal. Gestures of friendship moderate conduct. Moderation of language and habits were needed by church and state in Luther's day and are needed in ours. For the President of the United States, for example, to call the Soviet Union the source of all evil in the world is not only theologically and politically wrong, it makes it much more difficult for two very different political systems with precisely opposite theological bases to work together to avoid bloodshed. Martin Luther provided coarse language, but he also provided great music and sentences of simplicity and beauty. No one can improve on the simple, direct language and beauty of his morning prayer. I thank thee, my heavenly Father, through Jesus Christ, thy dear Son, that thou hast kept me this night from all harm and danger. And I pray thee that thou wouldst keep me this day also from sin and every evil, that all my doings in life may please thee. For into thy hands I commend myself, my body and soul, and all things. Let thy holy angel be with me, that the wicked foe may have no power over me. The most difficult of Luther's actions to understand is his anti-Semitism. While anti-Semitism has been the tragic heritage of much of the Christian era, Luther's advice to government leaders to mistreat Jews cannot be explained away that easily. At one point, Luther wrote, and I quote, "You dear princes and lords who protect and tolerate Jews among you, be aware of what you're doing. I do not wish to be responsible for the consequences." End of quote. Hitler's followers were able to quote anti-Jewish statements from Luther. But more important than that, there was enough of a heritage of anti-Semitism in that nation, which is half Lutheran and half Catholic, that Lutheran and Catholic leaders who should have spoken out in defense of the Jews were mostly mute. There are a few Catholic and Lutheran heroes we can point to, but shockingly few. Luther's urgings to obey the state are often cited as the reason for church silence, but Luther also advocated resistance to the state when appropriate. Whatever the cause, history cannot be changed. The land of Luther's birth will for generations bear the stigma of what Hitler did. But it is not enough to point to our German brothers and sisters or to place the blame on Luther. What are we doing today? Far too few Lutherans were in the forefront of helping to create a Jewish homeland and place of refuge in the Middle East. We should be among the leaders in working for peace in that strife-torn area and in making clear our support of the right of Israel to exist unharmed by her neighbors. And far too many sermons I hear from Lutheran and other pulpits, while not overtly anti-Semitic, they are all too obviously insensitive. In the Simon homes in Washington and in southern Illinois, we have a mezuzah at our door, a symbol Orthodox Jews have in their homes. We have had it for many years. It is intended as a gesture of friendship and kinship. What if in this 500th year of Luther's birth, thousands of Lutheran homes were to adopt this symbol as a token of friendship with our Jewish friends? It would be most appropriate. The worst example of racial oppression today is in the Union of South Africa, a nation in which those who call themselves Protestants are the ruling minority. Is there nothing more that church men and women can do than read about it in the newspapers? Should not there be a voice of deep concern from the churches of this country to those who share our heritage in South Africa? It is easy to see what Lutherans and Catholics did wrong in Germany a few decades ago. But what are we doing today to bring about justice and reconciliation in the Union of South Africa? Will millions die once again because the church spends more time and money on bowling teams and New Year's Eve parties and choir robes than it does on the problem of injustice in South Africa? Are there not ways that the church can do more than adopt resolutions to which no one pays attention? Martin Luther played an important role in reforming the church, in breaking the bonds of automatic submission to authority, religious and secular. In a very real sense, my ability to speak here tonight without fear of arrest or torture is part of his heritage. But that heritage rests on us uneasily. The 500th anniversary of Luther's birth is a time for looking back with appreciation, even as we note the defects. But like Martin Luther, we should spend most of our energy looking forward, recognizing our flaws as we strive toward a world with greater justice. If they were living, the prophet Amos, or Martin Luther, or St. Francis of Assisi would not be silent about the problems which afflict so many in our society and in our world. Nor should we be silent. Luther did not solve all of the political and religious problems of his time, nor will we. But we are a better world theologically and politically because he stood up. May future generations record that about us. Thank you.
Congressman Simon is willing to respond to some questions in the spirit that he usually volunteers that type of participation. To some of you, yes, right here in the front. Paul, if you want to come forward, maybe you can feel them just as fast.
Okay. You better pin a badge on you.
All right. Official. Question is, how do you solve the dilemma, and you correct me if I'm putting the question inaccurately, how do you solve the dilemma of the church providing leadership when what it may be saying at the top is different from what the majority of its members believe? How can you be sensitive both to the needs and to what your constituency believes? If the church wants to simply be popular, then it is very, and the politicians face the same kind of a dilemma. If the church or politicians want to be popular, then take polls, do what is popular, never lead. But then we should not call ourselves the servant church. A church which is not willing to be unpopular is not, in its fullest sense, a Christian church. I remember when open housing was a big thing. I was in the state legislature in Illinois. And the church leaders were sending us messages, we're for open housing. And we were getting letters from the members. And the members were writing a much, much different message, overwhelmingly. But church leaders who were willing to go out in the front eventually changed the opinion of membership and changed the opinions in government. This is perhaps the whole civil rights field is another good example. I recall when that final bill, when the bill was finally up for passage in the United States Senate, and at the beginning of the discussion, Senator Dirksen was one of those who opposed the civil rights bill, but then the churches went into action, church leaders really, and the church leaders hit Washington. I wasn't here at that time, and then Senator Dirksen changed his stand, and in his final debate with Senator Russell of Georgia, he said, "This is a moral issue." He had, in one way or another, become persuaded either that it was a moral issue or it was politically popular, whatever. But churches were willing to lead. I can also recall, this goes back quite a few years, when I published a newspaper in southern Illinois, and in Madison County we had wide open gambling, with underworld elements clearly controlling both political parties. And I was writing editorials. I was trying to get representative of the clergy to go before the county grand jury to say this is wrong, and then I could follow through. And the response I got from a great many members of the clergy, including Lutherans whom I contacted first, was, "I don't want to get mixed up in politics. this, you know, this would not be popular to do and so forth. Finally, the pastor of a little United Church of Christ parish in Marin, Illinois, Reverend Hayward Cale, never forget it, said, sure, I'll do it. And he went before the grand jury, and we got a lot of publicity on it, and all of a sudden our county overnight became amazingly clean because he was willing to stand up. I think the church has to stand up. And that means sometimes taking unpopular stands. That means sometimes pastors have to leave their parishes. Sometimes means politicians have to lose elections. But if we are not willing to risk a little, to dare a little, we have no business calling ourselves leaders. I cannot imagine Martin Luther saying, I don't think I want to get involved in this issue because it might be unpopular. Any other questions? Yes. The question is, was George Will stretching a point when he said that Martin Luther was one of the founding fathers of America? The answer is yes, he was stretching a point. But I don't think there is any question that Jefferson, for example, who referred to Luther a number of times in his writings, Jefferson and the others who were the founding spirits of our country, were influenced by Martin Luther a great deal. And even those who were not aware of being influenced, all of us are influenced by those who have gone before us and what they have done. And so we are influenced in ways we don't realize by a great many people. Question is, would I share a little bit on the arms race and how things look from my vantage point? Let me suggest there are two aspects to the arms race that concern me, one of which I think the church is in an excellent position to do something about. The one is the technical aspects of how many SS-20s and SS-4s and Pershing missiles and all of these things we have. And if tomorrow, and I want to get back to this, but if tomorrow we were to reach an accord with the Soviet Union on that, I am concerned that that accord might not last very long. There's another aspect to all of this, and that is building some bridges of understanding between people and between religious groups. I mentioned this. I recall vividly when our hostages were taken in Tehran, and I have through the years visited a great many Muslim countries, but all of a sudden I found myself reading about Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims, and I realized I have some understanding of the various divisions of Christianity and Judaism. But what my church and my culture and my education had provided me in a way of background to understanding the Muslim world was very, very limited. That's one of the things that we can do. And then simply to take a look at what we're doing in our communities. Churches that, for example, help a refugee are helping themselves ultimately also, in the way of understanding and other things. And for churches to maybe have scholarships where you would send a student, or you encourage traveling abroad, or you encourage visitors to come to your church. When I say visitors, not necessarily someone who makes a trip all the way across the ocean. Majority of college students who come from other countries into our country never during their years here ever have the privilege of having a meal with an American family in an American home. I think that is unfortunate for them. I think it is unfortunate for us. A congregation that would decide we're going to look at the nearest university and we're going to invite some foreign we're going to have a program of inviting foreign students into our homes so we can build those bridges, I think is extremely important. We now spend more money to build 1/4 mile of interstate highway than we do on all of our exchanges with the Soviet Union and the other Warsaw Pact countries. I suggest that's an imbalanced sense of priorities. Our exchange programs have generally been going down. Some of us are trying to get them back up a little bit right now. On college faculties, on campuses, a declining percentage of faculty members are teaching and studying abroad. And the whole area of foreign languages. We're the only nation on the face of the earth where you can go through grade school, high school, college, get a PhD, and never have a year of a foreign language. And that, in and of itself, conveys an arrogance to others. We're not interested in your culture. Now, that's the one side. I think we have to build the bridges of understanding. If we look only at the arms race and don't look at this other aspect that I think all of us can do something about, we're getting an imbalanced look at it. It is absolutely imperative that we put a little more reason and rationality into what we're doing in the arms race. I am not a pacifist. I recognize we have to have a defense and an adequate defense in this day and age, but we are arming ourselves into oblivion. Let me give you a little illustration. When I first sensed what we were doing, 2 years ago in September, down in Arkansas, an Air Force sergeant was walking along, dropped a wrench, it broke a little aluminum tube, and a Titan II missile went up in the air, landed in a wooded field. The warhead did not detonate, but the newspapers reported it was a 9-megaton warhead. And I got thinking, you know, we're always using the term megaton. I don't really understand what it means. So I asked our Congressional Research Service to get me the information, and they gave me I said, I want it in terms I can understand. They gave me two answers. One is, if you take all the bombs of World War II, including Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they total 2 megatons. Or second, if you read in El Salvador or Lebanon or someplace about a car blowing up, ordinarily that will be 1 or 2 or 3 pounds of TNT. Now, what happened in our Marine barracks and the embassy was a much larger amount of TNT. But in TNT equivalency terms, a megaton is a railroad freight train loaded with TNT 300 miles long. 9 megatons, 2,700 miles long, almost from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. The United States has roughly 9,500 what we call strategic warheads, larger warheads. The largest warhead tested, incidentally, Soviet warhead, underground testing is 60 megatons. The United States has about 9,500. The Soviets have about 9,000. In addition, we have about 30,000 smaller, what we call tactical nuclear warheads. We have the ability, beyond any question, to create a world where never again is the cry of a child going to be heard. Never again is a blade of grass going to grow. And somehow we have to get this under control. The answers are not simple. But the answers, at the same time, are primarily not technical. When we get into these debates and discussions, all of a sudden you hear a lot of very technical jargon. But the real problem is will. The real problem is this understanding thing I was talking about before. The real problem is fear. Very interesting, in Khrushchev's second book of memoirs, which incidentally still are not circulated in the Soviet Union, but in his second book of memoirs, he says after Stalin's death, the Soviet leadership believed the United States was going to invade the Soviet Union. Now, I don't know of anyone who was thinking about that. But we had so misunderstood each other that that fear was there. And somehow that has to change. That's what gets back to the understanding. We ought to encourage our young people to be not only the Soviet Union, but everywhere, so that we understand what's happening in Guatemala and El Salvador and everywhere else. Let me stretch your imagination just a bit. And I imagine 50 years ago that Yuri Andropov was a student for 1 year at Eureka College in Illinois, and Ronald Reagan was a student for 1 year at the University of Moscow. I think we would be living in a different world today. We don't know who the future Yuri Andropovs and Ronald Reagans are, but let's do what we can to see that young people who have the potential for leadership get the opportunity to learn a very simple lesson that people are people. Back there, yes. Well, one of the ways that you mentioned is not very dramatic, but it is effective, and that's writing letters. One of the organizations, if I may put in a plug, and I have a familial tie here, so you will have to take this with a grain of salt, perhaps, but Bread for the World, I think, is effective because they have organized those letters on a district-by-district, state-by-state basis. It is one thing to have someone here as a lobbyist in Washington, like Chuck Bergstrom. And he has some, and forgive me for saying this now, has some limited impact. What really has an impact is if back home in your district, people are writing letters. And it just takes a half a dozen letters to really frequently have an impact. Doesn't mean you're always going to have an impact, but that is very effective. Letters, they should not be word for word the same, let me hasten to add, which I am frequently, that is a problem. Petitions are very limited value. I once had the experience of a small public housing project where one resident was unhappy with her neighbor, and she got around a petition that her neighbor should be removed from the public housing project, and her neighbor heard about the petition. She got around a petition she should be permitted to stay. I got both petitions. Everyone in the housing project signed both petitions. It was a good illustration of the limits of that. One other thing, and that is take an active part in your political party so that when you contact your legislators, you're not an unknown quantity. If you're a Republican or a Democrat, get into your party. Doesn't mean you're going to have to vote the straight party ticket or anything like that. But get into your party, make it a finer party, and at the same time get acquainted with those who are in public office. You'll get an education, you'll contribute a great deal, and you'll find you have more weight. About three more questions, and then I should probably let you go home or wherever you're headed. Yes. There is a question whether, in fact, there are people who are missing in action. I think any clue ought to be explored. We have had congressional delegations going over. Primarily, we're talking about Vietnam and Laos. In the case of Laos, we have diplomatic relations, and there I think everything is being done that can be. In the case of Vietnam, well, let me back off, because Vietnam illustrates also one of the points in this bridge building and what we can do to build a better world and how we avoid some errors. Back in 1978, I was one of the delegates to the special session on disarmament. While I was there, I guess about 8 weeks in New York, I made it a point to try and meet people from other delegations that I would not ordinarily meet on the Washington scene. And so I went to the Vietnamese delegation in the UN hall there one day, and I said, asked them to come and have lunch with me, be my guest the next Tuesday. And they said they would have to check with Hanoi, and then they would get back to me. Well, they checked with Hanoi and got word that it was okay, and they had lunch with me and a representative of the State Department and Congressman Bill Layman from Florida, who happened to be up there that day. And among other things, they said they were interested in having diplomatic relations with the United States. And up to that point, if you recall, they felt they had a commitment from President Nixon for a $3 billion reparations payment, and they would not recognize the United States until that was paid. I said, would you like to come to Washington and explore it some more? And then they told me that under the laws of the United States, they couldn't go more than 25 miles from the UN, something I didn't realize until they told me that. Well, I said, they also wanted to check with Hanoi again. I said, well, you check with Hanoi about coming, and let me check with the State Department whether we can get you past the 25 miles, and then we'll see what we can work out. And we ended up having a dinner in Washington with some members of the House and the Senate, two representatives of the State Department, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals. And the Vietnamese delegation told us very candidly that they were under a great deal of pressure from the Soviet Union to take over Cam Ranh Bay, a great naval facility that the United States built, that they wanted to maintain independence, but they were getting pressured from both China and the Soviet Union. And if they could enter into diplomatic relations with us, it would help a great deal in maintaining their independence. Vietnam, incidentally, is the third largest communist nation in the world in terms of population, larger than Poland or Romania or the other Eastern Bloc countries. Well, we left that meeting that night, all of us agreeing that it would be a good thing to make this step. That was ultimately vetoed in the White House by someone for reason, either for political reasons, because recognizing Vietnam would not be popular, or because at that point we were negotiating with China for recognition. I don't know. Someday I want to find out the answer to why that was turned down. Some time later, I was talking to our UN ambassador, who said that one of the Vietnamese delegates came up to him and said, when the United States did not follow through on recognition, that they felt they were under pressure, that they were under pressure from the Soviets to invade Cambodia or Kampuchea. And had the United States recognized Vietnam, they would not have invaded Cambodia. What we lose by not recognizing this country that exists, is recognized by virtually all the world, is we get a little political pleasure perhaps out of saying we don't recognize you, but we're not able to follow through on the MIAs in Vietnam, whatever clues we have. We're not able to build bridges, and we're not able to encourage independence from the Soviet Union, which seems to me is clearly in our best interest. One more question, and then, okay, two more. Someone's pointing over here, and we'll get, and the gentleman over here. You get, okay.
Congressman, some commentators have observed that today, and I mean no disrespect, there's got to be a person from President.
I've had a few people show disrespect to me, so go ahead.
I thought I could launch.
Well, I agree. You heard the question back there. It is a major problem. And if you will forgive, personal reference, I happen to be involved in a Senate campaign in the state of Illinois. Our budget for the primary is $1.5 million. Our budget for the general election is $2.5 million. And we figure we're going to be outspent. Now, the question is, how do you raise that kind of money? And how do you do it in such a way that you're really responding to people who have the great needs? And it is a problem. I have never, in all my years in politics, never promised anyone anything for any campaign contribution. But let's just say when I'm finished here, 20 minutes to 10, I have some things I've got to do when I finish here before I start out tomorrow morning, and then let's say there are 20 phone calls waiting for me. Every one of the phone calls on the bottom is going to say urgent, important. 19 of those names are people whose names I don't recognize. The 20th is someone who gave me a $1,000 campaign contribution. Now, at 11 o'clock tonight, I'm not going to make 20 phone calls. I might make one. Which one do you think I'm going to make? You're right. And what that means is the financially articulate have an inordinate access to policymakers. And that is not a healthy thing. And it means that when we struggle for other problems, for example, we have 23 million functionally illiterate adult Americans in this country. A massive problem, a hidden problem that we don't pay any attention to. But no one's going to give me a campaign contribution and then start talking to me about functionally illiterate Americans. There's no profit for anyone in that. And so they become incidental in a campaign to much too great an extent. And in addition to the access problem, candidates have to spend an awful lot of time just soliciting people for contributions. It is distasteful. It is... And even when, part of it I don't like also is, even when no one says anything, when someone comes into your office and you know that person has given a contribution and you do feel grateful to people who have given a contribution, but you always wonder in the back of your mind, if you agree with them, do they think you're agreeing with them because they gave you a contribution? And that makes the whole relationship an unpleasant one. I think one of these days we have to move toward doing what we did on the presidency. We have public financing now on the presidency. I don't think anyone would want to go back to the old days where you almost bought the presidency. And yet we're doing that in political life much too great an extent. There's a new book out by Elizabeth Drew. It's called, it's either Money and Politics or Politics and Money. I forget which. But it is worth reading. Just a little, it's a small book, but it gives you an insight into something that is dramatically wrong in our society. The function of government ought to be not to pander to the wishes of the rich and the powerful, but to help people who really need help. Our system of financing campaigns encourages precisely the opposite. Now, gentlemen back there, you get the last question. Make it a good one. I don't know what his immediate situation is, and if he For example, today, in fairness, for example, I had a small student group that was scheduled. My schedule was fairly tight today, and while I try and meet student groups, Faith Burgess here is about once a year brings a group from Gettysburg Seminary I meet with. Isn't there what? Philadelphia. Oh. When you've seen one LCA seminary, you've seen them all, you know. let me digress for just a moment to say, as a Missouri Synod Lutheran here, that my daughter went to Wittenberg, a fine LCA school, and she thoroughly enjoyed her experience there. Now, getting back to your question, but I had, because of votes and some involvement on the floor, I had to call over to my office and say, please apologize to the group, but I just can't meet with them. Now, whether something like that happened, I don't know. If that is not the case, if that representative was just giving you the brush off, I would plan to get active in the next election in your district in Minnesota. I think that's the way our process works, and as soon as that person sees you become active, he or she is going to be either defeated or much more responsive next time you come around. Let me just add one final word of appreciation to whoever put all this together, and then tie it in with suggesting that all of you really can make a difference. I don't think Martin Luther had the vaguest idea what he was doing when he posted those 95 theses on the university chapel door at Wittenberg. And I don't think any of us can have any idea what we can do for good through our activity, by the little things, by building the bridges, by doing the other things that need to be done, by talking to your representative about Central America and other things. And I don't think sometimes we understand how much we contribute for ill through our inattention and inactivity. We are living in a world that desperately calls for people like you to become involved. And we are, frankly, comfortable enough, all of us in this room. We're all going to be well-fed tomorrow. We have been well-fed today. We will sleep well in a nice home or a nice hotel room. It is easy to forget people who don't share those things with us. And part of calling ourselves Christians, however inadequately we all live our faith, is that we should not be walking by on the other side. Great to be with you. Thank you very much.